These are some of the steepest kilometers of the entire bike race on the Puy de Dôme. And it kind of sticks up out of the middle of nowhere and has, I think, 2 kilometers at 12%. The average is 6-7% for the whole climb. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult. Welcome back to the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. Joining me today to talk Tour de France. We're doing a big deep dive on the Tour de France route today. We're going to go stage by stage. We're going to talk about all the biggest, scariest stages. We're going to talk about the kind of unique way that it's going to make its way across France this year. And joining me to chat through that, Dane Cash. How are you, Dane?
I'm doing good, Kaylee. How are you?
I'm great. And it's not your first time on the podcast, is it, Joe?
On placeholders, oh. I think, other than the quick interview I did with you and Wade pre-launch.
That's right.
You came over to my kitchen and we recorded
that's
a
right.
segment as
that's
well.
That's right. I forgot
but,
all.
Yeah, that was a standalone segment. Yeah.
Well, for everybody out there who only listens to our podcast, you may not be familiar with Joe Lindsay, but Joe is an integral part of the Escape Collective. Biggest story people would have read from you recently was a pretty in-depth investigation into the ZAF issue, which is what you guys were talking about on your kitchen table. Joe's going to join for today's episode as we talk through the tour. Before we get into that, though, I do need to mention and I need to thank some of our lifetime members. If you listen to this podcast regularly, you know that Escape Collective is member-funded. We're kept going by those of you out there who have signed up. And our lifetime members, our most dedicated fans, we want to send a special shout out to these folks every single week. So this week, Todd Potter, Claire Law, Glenn Murphy, Stephen Harris, and Dave Munro. Thank you so much for being lifetime members in Escape Collective. We hugely appreciate your support. And if you're not already a member, head over to escapecollective.com/join and join. Please and thank you. So today's episode is going to be a bit different. We're not going to sort of bounce around and talk about the news of the week. We'll touch on a couple interesting things, particularly if they're Tour de France related. But like I said, today is going to be a tour route deep dive. So if you want to sort of prep yourself mentally for the coming month, you want to know what's going to be interesting, what stages to definitely tune in for, how we think this race might kind of unfold, and the tapestry upon which the race will be painted, we're going to talk all about that. Dane, I think we decided to go basically stage by stage here, right? So before we do that, though, I do want to kind of provide a 10,000-foot view, a 3,000-meter view of what this tour looks like from afar, right? Like, how does it fit in, kind of contextualize it for me based off of recent Tours de France? What does it feel like to you?
I've got two kind of major takeaways when looking at this Tour de France route. The first is this is a climbers Tour de France, even for 2023. We talk about races these days being climbers or time tower related, and it's all relative. Recently, racing is just far more climber oriented than it was 30 years ago. Even for that, this is a climber friendly Tour de France. There's one TT, it has a climb in it, and everything else is all about the climbs in this race. So I think it's going to be a race that the riders who are going to try to challenge the two big favorites are probably going to appreciate that fact, because those two big favorites, you know, Jonas Vingegaard and Tadej Pogacar, are really good time trialists, and they're just not going to get to use that skill as much. So I'm thinking that, you know, the David Godus of the world will be pleased that the climbing is going to be the main focus. The other big takeaway is the fact that, unusually for a Grand Tour, we get into the action right away. We don't have to wait for week three. And actually, week three is just, it's hard, but it's not like we've seen it the vast majority of other Grand Tours lately where it has all of the action packed into it. It's going to be pretty spread out. The hard stages are really spread out throughout this Tour de France.
Agreed on both of those counts, Dane. And we are about to publish a pretty in-depth sort of route preview breakdown thing over on escapecollective.com. And one of the charts I put together when I was making that piece was this. I kind of invented my own metric a little bit, and I charted out each stage, and I gave each stage kind of a 1 to 10 subjective ranking on how hard it would be for the GC favorites, or the other way to think about it is sort of how much jeopardy there was for the GC in that particular stage. So, you know, there's a bunch of stages that are up kind of in the 9 range. Those are the ones with lots of big, massive climbs. If you get a 9, it probably has an uphill finish as well, or some, I think one of them is sort of a pretty scary downhill descent finish. All the way down to 1, which is a, you know, it's a sprint stage, right? Like, unless something goes horribly wrong and you crash, there's no actual GC jeopardy in those stages. And the interesting thing for me as I kind of charted this out, and the reason I did it is because everybody's been kind of talking about how this Tour de France is really front-loaded. And you mentioned that just now, is that it is kind of unusual that we get into the action as quickly as we do this year. But front-loaded is maybe not really quite the right term. It's front-loaded sort of relative to previous tours. But that first week relative to, well, basically the 2/3 of the way through as we get into the Alps is really not, it's not front loaded, right? Like the race is not going to be decided in the first 4 days. And I feel like a lot of the sort of chatter around this tour route has been more in that direction. And that feels, well, feels wrong to me. It feels a bit disingenuous to me.
Yeah, it really just feels like the front loaded, quote unquote, just means, yeah, it's relative. It just means there's actually going to be a chance for GC action in the first week. Particularly at the later half of that first kind of 1/3 of the race. And if you look back across quite a few Grand Tours recently, that just doesn't happen. We just get sprint stages or, you know, punchy stages where I guess there are chances for GC riders to do stuff, but they never do. I'm looking at these profiles, and I think there's a significant chance that we'll actually get to see some battles among the GC riders here.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing, once I sort of mapped all this out, and I, again, this, you know, the actual ratings are subjective, and you could probably argue sort of a point or two here and there for a lot of these stages, but that doesn't really matter for this particular exercise. It was more to kind of visualize the difficulty and how it was spread out throughout the 3 weeks, right? And when you do that, it's really clear that the tour has, I think, quite purposefully, you know, Thierry Gouvenou, who does the tour route, he's kind of the head tour route designer. I think this is quite purposeful in that there really is never more than 2 days without some kind of GC jeopardy, right? Never more than 2 days of just sort of pure bunch sprint or something that is almost certainly not going to be a GC day. Now, there are a lot of days that are kind of somewhere in between. There's days where, you know, you look at them and you're like, all right, that's probably mostly a breakaway day. Maybe there's a bit of action behind, but, you know, it'll basically entirely depend on whether the racers decide to race, as opposed to some of these big, massive alpine stages where they're hard enough, it doesn't really matter what the racers end up trying to do. It's going to be decisive regardless. Yeah, so an interesting route from that perspective, and not something we have seen at the Tour de France in at least in recent years. They're definitely trying to make an effort to, I don't know, tilt the thing toward the modern attention span, if that makes any sense. Like I said, no more than 2 stages in a row where we're going to sit there and go, ah, it's just another sprint stage.
Yeah, I think to expand on what you and Dane were both saying, the thing that really stands out to me about this route is how distributed the racing is. And I think as far as the racers themselves go, that might manifest in 2 ways. One of which is that for the GC riders, they're really going to be focused on consistency, on not having a bad day. But the flip side of that is that if they do, they're not necessarily out of it. I don't think this is that there are definitely going to be guys who fall down the standings pretty far in that before that first rest day. But I think for someone who has like a moderately bad day, there are chances for them to get back into the race. And the way that especially the stages in week 2 and week 3 look, there are some chances for kind of bold and aggressive racing that might pay off in a big way.
Yeah, we'll get to this at the very end of the show, but I really want to talk about stage 20, which finishes in Le Marc-Stein, and it just looks like it looks like somewhere you'd set a trap, basically, to me, is what that stage looks like. And I'm kind of excited about that one. If the GC is still close at stage 20, that stage is going to be awesome. Anyway, let's get into it. We're going to literally start on stage 1, and some of them we're going to breeze right through and some of them we're going to spend a little more time on. But stage one, it turns out, is one that we should probably spend a little bit more time on. So, Dane, talk me through as briefly as you can, stage one of this year's Tour de France.
The race opens, for anyone who doesn't know, the Tour de France actually starts in Spain this year, in Bilbao. It's a Basque country start to the 2023 Tour de France. And Bilbao gets the opening stage. And as anyone who follows racing earlier in the year and watches the Tour of the Basque Country, or who watches San Sebastian, will know, there are a lot of punchy little climbs in the Basque Country. And we get a nice inclusion of some punchy climbs right from the get-go in this race. The first stage of the Tour de France, so often either a short time trial or a sprint stage, has some pretty tricky little climbs at the end of it. Going to be an interesting one, I think. Going to be really cool. There's going to be, I think, 10K from the finish. Yeah, 10K from the finish. There is a 2 kilometer long climb with an average gradient of 10%, which is really steep. So I'm hoping that we're going to see some action there. We talked a little bit about this the other day, Kaylee. Julian Alaphilippe would be the, you know, the rider that we might think is the star favorite for this. But, you know, recently we don't really know what to expect from him. So maybe the GC guys will get involved.
Well, and we saw a very similar stage won by Jonas Vingegaard at the Dauphiné this year. And we talked a little bit about that on the podcast at the time and how I think it means that he's really put a heavier focus on stages like that and on climbs like that, because this Tour de France is full of sort of small moments like that that are not maybe an hour-long climb up the Tourmalet, although that takes them a lot less than an hour. It takes me an hour. And more like 7 minutes up one of these, or 10 minutes up one of these kind of steeper things, particularly in the first week. And it looks clear that Jonas Vingegaard has paid attention to that. Granted, you know, the Dauphiné field was not what the Tour de France field will be, but he rode away with that stage, and he looked extremely, extremely strong in that kind of climb. I mean, left Julian Alaphilippe in the dust, for one. So yeah, that stage one, where let's you know, remind everybody, yellow jersey, green jersey, polka dot jersey, white jersey, all on the line in that stage. So there is no prologue. There is no opening time trial. This first stage and that climb are going to determine who wears all those jerseys, probably for a day or two at least, although we'll get into stage two, which is also quite difficult. There's a huge amount on the line in these sort of very difficult roads, punchy roads, difficult climbs. And I think it'll be a fascinating, fascinating opening stage. Moving on to stage two, from Vitoria Gasteiz to Saint Sebastian. I said that in the French version, which is this. Actually, I need to go fix it in our preview. We haven't published it yet, so I can still go do this. But the French put like Saint Sebastian in French, and it took me a second to realize that they had done this to Saint Sebastian. It ends in Saint Sebastian. Another quite difficult run in. Including the Jaiskebel, which is is it Jaiskebel? Jaiskebel?
This one's tricky, Kaylee, because it's Jaiskebel in Spanish, but this is Basque country, so I don't actually know what the Basque people would say about this.
Right.
Should
we just like go English and call it the Jaiskebel or something like that?
Yeah, Jaiskebel. I'm sure nobody will have any problem with us calling it the Jaiskebel. Yeah.
Anyway, the Jaiskebel, which is it's the final climb in Clásico de San Sebastián, which is a sort of very old, famous one-day race, currently placed right after the Tour de France. It seems to be contested primarily by Bauke Mollema every year, and it's a phenomenal, phenomenal, interesting climb with a pretty tricky descent off the backside. And it's a finale that any racer who has done San Sebastian in the past will know. And it always makes for a great one day, and I think it will also make for a great stage two. The other thing that's worth noting is that at the top of that final climb are bonus seconds. There are extra bonus seconds in this Tour de France. This has been something that's been the case for the last couple of years. I believe it's 8, 4, and 2 second bonuses. I will go double check that. But anyway, there are not only bonus seconds at finishes now, there are also bonus seconds on select climbs kind of near the finish, and the Jaiskebel is an example of that.
Yeah, and I think that's, you mentioned that, Kaylee, and that's also the case for stage one, that last kicker right before the finish line has bonus seconds as well. So I think we're going to see, both of those days, we're going to see sort of two finish lines in this race, one at the top of the climbs for the bonus seconds, and then guys trying to stay with the pack, knowing that even if they cross the finish at same time in, 15th place, they might be yellow jersey. So I think that's going to have a really interesting impact on the racing.
Corrections corner already. The time bonuses that are awarded, it's 10, 6, and 4 seconds at the finish lines, and 8, 5, and 2 seconds on these special bonus climbs. So, 8 seconds is significant. And if you could, in particular, take a number of them, you could end up with, 30, 40 seconds by the end of the race over your rival. So I think that we are absolutely going to see riders pay attention to those and go for them. And it should make those finales in stage one and stage two even more interesting. I don't think we're going to see, for example, like Jonas Vingegaard or Tadej Pogacar take yellow in those first two stages. Although it's of course possible. I would say Pogacar is probably the more likely of the two to just sort of go for it. But I do think that we're gonna see a fair amount of GC action and probably see at least sort of maybe one or two with a kind of B-list GC stars fall away a little bit already. And I think that makes a particularly interesting intro to the race.
Could set them up for, breakaways later too, those riders who fall behind. That could just be something they're doing kind of semi-intentionally even.
Yeah. Joe, let's get on to stage three.
Yeah, this is the last stage of the Grand Depart and takes us out of the Basque Country into France. This starts in Amora Bieta Etxano and takes us basically up the coast to France to the finish in Bayonne. And this stage is where the race is finally going to start to calm down a little bit, because there are four categorized climbs, including one early that could definitely be kind of a launching pad for an early breakaway. But it really settles down in the second half of the stage, and on paper, it looks like a sprint. The big question mark here, I think, is Crosswinds. They're going to spend a significant amount of the day on the bay, on the coast. And so depending on the strength and the direction of those crosswinds, that could absolutely change the racing and turn it from being, a chill day into being absolute pandemonium where everybody's trying to stay up front. Everybody's trying to make it into the split.
It's interesting. I feel like this is one of the very few stages that actually goes along the coast. I feel like the Tour de France often has stages that give us opportunities for crosswinds on the coast. We get a lot of stages in Brittany, a lot of stages in Normandy, the western edge of central France. This year, almost none of that. And that's sort of, this is going to be one of the few days that actually goes along the coast and has that opportunity. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about the sort of the general route earlier, but it is a kind of a weird, it's a weird route. Like, we should just say that out loud. It's a weird, it's like unlike anything I have personally covered, and this will be tour number 13 for me. It just sort of goes generally northeast for the entirety of the race. It skips the entire northwest of the country. It also just like hangs out for a while in two different places. Like we're gonna hang out in Clermont-Ferrand for like 4 days, and then we're gonna hang out basically in the same sort of like valley of the Alps for like 4 or 5 days, including a rest day. So that's very unusual. And I mean, I don't mind it from a covering the race perspective. It's going to be a bit less driving for us and a bit less stress around like finding hotels and getting dinner and things like that. But it is definitely it is also, I should mention this, and I don't know if this is purposeful. In fact, we want to ask the ASO this when we get to France next week, whether sustainability had anything to do with it, because I do genuinely think it's going to be a bit less just sort of moving around than previous races. Like I when I mapped out a lot of the driving, it looked like maybe sort of 1,000, maybe even 1,500 kilometers less driving than some of the races we've had recently.
Yeah, from a tourism driving perspective, which is such an important goal of basically every bike race, and there's no French Riviera. There's so little of the Atlantic coast after you get out of the Basque Country. It's just really interesting decisions made across the route. But I think it does look like a cool route. It's just different.
Let's keep going. We need to get through all these. Dax to Nogaro, stage four. Whoa, this was pretty boring.
Yeah. Sprint stage.
I shouldn't say boring. Yeah. It'll be a sprint stage.
Yeah.
But, it's got, I shouldn't say, it's, I actually, a brief thing about this. It finishes on the Nagaro auto racing track. And the last stage to finish on this particular auto racing track, motor racing track, was in 2017 at Route du Sud. And it was won by Tom Scully. And Tom Scully is not a bunch sprinter, as you all know. Tom Scully, riding for EF, he's more sort of like a strongman kind of classics kind of guy. And he actually was in a breakaway of, I think it was like 10 or 12 riders. And they were caught on the finish line by the peloton. And so Ilia Viviani finished like 7th or 8th. I think Brian Cocard was right around the same place. Those were the sort of the front of the peloton. My point being here, though, is that motor racing tracks are actually really difficult to mount a chase on, because they're just full of corners. Like, they're just around sort of these sweeping corners all over the place, and they're really difficult to fully get, like you're not going to get the sort of 3, 4, 5 kilometer long straight where a peloton can go 65K an hour and pull back a breakaway really easily. And so I actually think that this is one of those stages that possibly, if the sprinter teams leave it too late, they could get caught out. Because basically that's exactly what happened last time a bike race came here. So it's just something to keep an eye on for this Nagaro stage. Which brings us to stage 5. We're not that far into the race yet, and we're going into the Pyrenees. And this is the other reason why people have been talking about the front of this race being front-loaded, or the beginning of this race being front-loaded, is that, one, we've got this sort of tricky stages in Basque Country really early, but then we also just get into the Pyrenees, like legit Pyrenees, really, really quickly. So stage 5, Joe, walk me through it.
Right. Stage 5 is our first true mountain day. We go, it's 162.7 kilometers, and the start is in Po, a longtime rest stage favorite for the tour. There's three categorized climbs. The first is the Col de Sudet, 15.2K. It's rated as an HC climb, 7.2% average. I think the most interesting part of this, though, is that the race then sets up to the Col de Marie Blanc, kind of close to the end. It's only about 18 kilometers. The summit's only about 18K from the finish. The descent off that can be a little tricky in spots, but then you also get a slightly like false flat uphill run to the line in La Ronde. So this feels to me very much like a breakaway stage. Maybe if the Nogaro finish doesn't produce a break, this could be like the first true breakaway stage of the tour.
Yeah, and I could see the GC teams kind of hoping actually that a breakaway goes, because there are bonus seconds available at the top of the Marie Blanc, and frankly, they don't want any of their competitors to be able to take those. So if the breakaway takes all those seconds, I think all the GC men will be pretty happy with that. I think we should take a brief moment for anybody who is not as fluent in tour speak, which I know, you know, the tour does attract folks who are slightly less fully engaged in the sport of cycling. Brief note on climb categorization. So, or category, which literally means like outside of categorization in French. That's the highest. That's the biggest, nastiest, most terrible climbs in the Tour de France, all the way down to category 4. Category 4 are sort of like, you know, for us, it would be a significant climb. For the Tour de France, they hardly notice it, unless it's sort of right in the finale of a race or of a stage. So that's the scale. Big mountain days are often full of sort of cat ones and cat twos and maybe one or two category climbs. And then sort of the hillier days are full of these cat threes, cat fours, maybe one cat two. That's kind of how this all splits out. So that stage 5, first day in the Pyrenees, followed up by another difficult day in the Pyrenees, a slightly shorter one. Tarbes to Cotteret-Cambasque. Uphill finish. This is the first sort of serious uphill finish of the Tour de France. And Cotteret is a kind of deceptive climb. It's a category 1. And prior to it, the peloton will have tackled the Col de Tourmalet, which is massive. It's an or category climb, 17 kilometers at 17.3%. My guess is we won't see a whole lot of action on that Tourmalet. It's just a bit too early in the race. I don't think we're going to see GC riders that want to burn up matches on a climb that difficult this early. Not only this early in the 3 weeks, but also sort of too far away from the finish line of the actual stage. But we should see some action on the Cotteret. I think it's not incredibly steep on average. The average is only 5.3% over 15K. But there are a couple sections right near the top. There's a sort of 2 kilometer section between kind of kilometer 13 and 14, meaning like, you know, within a couple kilometers of the finish line, that average 10%. So if anybody does go, it'll probably be kind of a late move, you know, a Garrett Thomas style move in those final 3 or 4 kilometers. And we could see someone try to make a jump on that ramp.
This is the first stage where I'm really looking for GC riders who have a bad day, like some of the B-level GC contenders really falling out. I think, you know, the Tourmalet in particular is such a massive climb. It's an absolute leg softener. And so once they get to the Calderet climb, as you pointed out, Kaylee, that kick close to the end is the kind of place where if a guy's been sort of faking it and hanging on, there's going to be no hiding when you get to that spot, especially if riders start to attack off the front, which I do expect to happen.
We talked about this on another podcast recently, where the big question mark for Tadej Pogacar coming into this race is obviously how he's doing after spending a few weeks, well, months out of racing. And I think if Jonas Vingegaard and Jumbo-Visma want to be especially ruthless and effective, possibly, they might be aggressive early on in this race if Pogacar is trying to build into form. And the fact that he's going to have to go over the Tourmalet as sort of like a appetizer for the final climb, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Jumbo-Visma is actually pretty aggressive here and tries to take advantage of the gradients and the possible opportunity that Pogacar's not quite at his very best early on in the race.
The Tourmalet this far from the finish feels like a team climb. It feels like where you, if you want to grab hold of the race, you put your whole team up there, you know. Yeah. Well, we should mention this as well. This is one of our little news bits for this week. But so this week, Primoz Roglic announced that he will not be at the Tour de France. Our own Kate Wagner was actually in the room when he did that, got the quotes over to us. So Jumbo will be riding these stages without Roglic, which is something that they did not have to do last year. I don't think that necessarily does a whole lot of damage to them in terms of like they're still going to be the strongest team in the race, I think. But that's certainly a pretty important player in the 2022 Tour de France. You could very much argue that he was, you know, mostly responsible for setting up the victory on the Grand Am for Jonas Vingegaard. So not having him is a big deal. And in particular on a stage like this, if they really wanted to push the pace, somebody like that would have been quite helpful. Moving out of the Pyrenees, we're already into stage 7 here. We're starting to head north.
Yeah, we get another sprint stage here, and I don't think the profile has all that many challenges on this stage. I'd be pretty surprised if anything all that fascinating happens. Fortunately, it's relatively short. It's not a, you know, 250 kilometer boring sprint stage. It's only 169.9, and the real highlight is the fact that the stage finishes in Bordeaux, in the city of Bordeaux. And technically, I think the finish line is on the left side of the Garonne River, and that is, of course, the left bank is where the best Bordeaux wine comes from. And if you want more of that sort of thing, just stay tuned. I'll tell you why the left bank has better Bordeaux wine in the coming days.
I look forward to that. I look forward to that. I think this is going to be, what is this? Is this sprint stage number 3? We're going to be getting into the point now where if Mark Cavendish has not won a stage, that the hysteria begins, particularly with our British colleagues. This is a good opportunity for him. This is a good stage, I think, for him. It's a good finale for him. I'm gonna put a little random prediction in this very early podcast and say this is the home of Mark Cavendish's record breaking tour stage win. And you better believe that if I'm right, we're gonna clip that out and play it again on the Tour Daily.
Celebrate with some wine.
Oh, I will be. So after our Bordeaux finish, our Mark Cavendish stage win, we do have a bit more sort of transition here. Joe, what does stage 8 look like?
Stage 8's an interesting one because of, like, if you look at the profile on paper, you'd say, oh, this is probably going to be like a pure sprint finish. But this is the longest stage in the race so far. It's 200.7 kilometers from Libourne to Limoges. But the finish is just slightly uphill. So it's not going to be like a really big Mark Cavendish kind of day. This is more like, I think you pointed out in the written race preview that's going to be up on Escape soon. This is like classic, like peak era Peter Sagan type finish. So those are the kinds of riders that I would be looking for. I'd be looking for somebody like Michael Matthews, except for he has also announced that he's not going to be here. So I think it's really going to open it up. It's going to be a fascinating finish, and you could, because of the fact that the pure sprinters are maybe not as advantaged on a day like today, this could be turning into one of those days that's a little bit of a fight between a breakaway and the uphill finishers.
So the actual finale is 2.8 kilometers at 4.8% average, and it kind of stair steps a little bit. So I wonder if someone like Caleb Ewan could get himself to the finish line. You know, some of these sprinters who we have seen, for example, if you could get over the Poggio with something near the front group, you're probably the type of rider who, if you find form at the right time, could get to the finish line on this stage. And so, yeah, Matthews, I mean, obviously, like, Wout van Aert is the obvious one. But I do think, I think Caleb Ewan will probably be looking at this and thinking, you know, if I position myself well and I have good legs, I could maybe get there. And if I do get there, I could maybe win this thing. But it'll very much depend on sort of legs on the day. And I would still put his chances of being anywhere near the finish at 50-50.
Yeah, I think obviously another guy we haven't talked about is Matthew Van Der Poel. Would be an obvious pick for today, for this day, because it's not really a Jasper Philipsen kind of day. I think Van Aert is interesting to me because he's already announced that he will leave the race if he needs to for the birth of his child. And so there's sort of an unknown clock ticking on his chances to win stages. He's going to want to get them early rather than late,
and it means that he doesn't have the green jersey locked up before the race even begins, and right. So I think there's going to be a fair amount of battling for every single one of these finishes, and probably quite a few of the sort of mid-stage sprint points. And this stage is a perfect example of sprint point comes 79 kilometers in after just a bunch of flat, and so we could potentially see sprint teams keeping a breakaway either very small or very close, and so potentially overhauling it even ahead of those sprint points to try to get a few more points for their chosen sprinter. Which brings us up a little bit further north. We're now into the Massif Central. So this Tour de France does touch every single one of the five French mountain ranges. Pyrenees, Alps, Vosges, Jura, and Massif Central. And now we're in the Massif Central, and we are going to be headed to the highest point in the Massif Central, the highest mountain, or at least the highest mountain with a road on it, I should say. That's a point of clarification. The Puy de Dôme, which is a old volcano, and also the home of one of the greatest battles in, well, probably the last 50 years of tour history. It was just an iconic moment between Raymond Poulidor and Jacques Anquetil, and kind of the closest that Poulidor ever came to finally winning. Basically, he never won the Tour de France, and finally beating Jacques Anquetil at the Tour. He actually dropped Anquetil on the Puy de Dôme, took a bunch of time back, but due to a whole bunch of other things that happened in that race, was still a bit too far back. It is hard. These are some of the steepest kilometers of the entire bike race on the Puy de Dôme, and it kind of sticks up out of the middle of nowhere and has, I think, 2 kilometers at 12%. The average is 6-7% for the whole climb. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult, and it's going to come kind of smack in the middle of a pile of otherwise not particularly difficult GC stages. So I'm interested to see how the legs kind of respond to, well, we've had a bunch of days of kind of sprinty stages. The GC riders probably haven't had to do a whole lot. They're going to come into the bottom of the Puy de Dôme with a relatively large group because the rest of the stage is Cat 4, Cat 4, Cat 3, not enough to really separate any of the top riders. And then it's basically going to be a, you know, half-hour power test, watts per kilo test, up the Puy de Dôme to the finish line.
And, you know, just this is sort of a basic point, but the finish is so steep, double digits, that it's kind of almost impossible for there not to be some time gaps. It's just really hard to like roll across the line within a second of each other when you're going up double digits in the final, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 minutes.
The other thing that I would note about this climb is it's like a classic example of how unusual this year's route is. The last time the Puy de Dôme featured in any race was the 1988 Tour de France and Tour de France Féminine. And so this is a situation where not only did none of the riders in this year's race have any sort of experience or sort of familiarity with this climb, but there's almost no institutional knowledge of it either. Like, even their directors haven't raced this. So I would imagine a number of guys have probably gone to recon it, and that will tell them something. But the thing that that doesn't tell them is how it will be raced. And I think that's going to be a really interesting wild card on this stage particularly.
Yeah, I'm excited about this one. And I know the tour organizer is quite excited about this one. They I think there were issues with sort of concerns over environmental impact and things like that up there for a long time. And I, for whatever reason, those have been assuaged, and they are, yeah, they're now prepared to go up it once again. Moving on to stage 10. Oh, wait, rest day. I should mention that. We've got a little rest day. When I mentioned earlier that we're going to be sitting in Clermont-Ferrand for like 5 days, this is part of the reason why. We got a rest day smack in the middle, and then a couple more stages that kind of go in and out of that city. Stage 10, though, Volcania, which is right outside Clermont-Ferrand, to Issoire, 167K.
Classic breakaway day. Yeah, you got five climbs, day after rest day. GC guys are not going to want to be aggressive. It's kind of relentlessly up and down all day. And then there's a sort of a slight downhill to the finish in Issoire. So this just reads classic breakaway day to me.
Agreed. Moving on to stage 11, we're still in Clermont-Ferrand. In fact, this stage starts in Clermont-Ferrand and ends in Moulins. 180K. Dane, this one seems pretty sprinty to me, although there's certainly going to be a concerted effort to get a big breakaway move going in that first half of the profile, which is full of Cat 4s.
Yeah, this feels like a stage where if the sprinters actually really want it to be a sprint stage, it will be a sprint stage. They're just going to have to kind of work together, and that doesn't always happen. The route, though, does lend itself to being a sprint stage because by the end of it, things are flat enough that you would think that things will come back together.
Stage 12, Rohan to Bellevue-en-Beaujolais. This gets a bit more interesting.
This one, to me, has all the markings of like a KOM jersey kind of raid, because you've got five climbs, including two Category 2s late in the race. This feels like, to me, a day where, you know, that last climb, the summit is about close to 30K from the finish in Bellevue and Beaujolais. And there are bonus seconds at the top of that climb. But I think at this point in the race, those are going to start to be maybe a little bit less crucial to the GC contenders. So I can definitely see sort of those guys sitting back and letting a breakaway go with guys who are focused primarily on the KOM and stage win.
Yeah, and it starts basically up a hill. Like, we get into this sort of small rise up to Montigny and then a Category 3. So the riders that make it into that breakaway are going to be good climbers. There's no question about that. And then they will get to duke it out on these sort of final two Cat 2s. They will definitely want to use those Cat 2s to get rid of any of the dead weight in that group. We probably end up, I think, with a relatively small group. I'm talking 1 to 5 riders coming into the finish, even though I think the initial breakaway to go off is probably more like in the 15 to 20 range, right? It's going to probably be a relatively large group.
Another important wine region, by the way. So at the end of the stage, you could celebrate with some Gamay, which is a very underrated grape. If you like your Pinot Noir, you're going to like this, the Beaujolais wine. Again, more of that whenever we can talk about it. I'm going to talk about it.
Well, let's get into stage 13, because then we are back into the mountains. Now, this is a slightly strange stage. It kind of reminds me of the Planche de Bellevue stage last year, where it was not a whole lot going on for most of the stage, and then this kind of chaotic, power test again, kind of like Puy de Dôme, power test to the top of the final climb. This is going up Grand Colombier, which is 17.4K at 7.1%. The big thing for me is the last couple kilometers, they turn north. So the bottom of the climb is lots of switchbacks. The last couple K, they turn north. And the climb also kind of levels out a little bit at that point. The wind is going to have a huge impact on whether riders decide to go or not. So basically, if there's a headwind on that section, if the wind is out of the north, then I could see the GC favorites kind of holding back a little bit, because I think that they won't want to be riding that those last couple K into a headwind. And if there's a tailwind, wind out of the south, then I could think we could see them go for it. So the wind, I think, will play a large role in how this one ends up playing out.
I really hope there are multiple GC riders on a single team still in contention by this point in the race, because I like the potential for sort of attacks and counterattacks by a team that's trying to leverage multiple, you know, a multi-pronged attack on this particular climb because of the sort of the stair-step nature of it. We'll see if that actually happens. I always want that to happen. It very rarely happens, but maybe.
You never know. We should also mention that this is Bastille Day, and so the French riders, and in particular Thibaut Pinot, is going to want to win this stage. There's no question about that. For anybody who's watched Unchained, you know that he tried to do the same thing on Planche de Belfi last year. I would say if he does the same thing this year on this particular stage, it would be in error, because I don't think he's going to win the power test that's going to be required to take this thing. I would go after a different stage if I were him, but perhaps David Gaudu would be looking at this one as a sneaky moment to take a stage win if he is indeed still riding at the front of the race. Let's get into stage 14. We're heading deeper into the Alps at this point. Annemasse, which is in right on the Swiss border, heading up into Morzine. And in particular, the descent into Morzine, I think, is worth mentioning here. This is not an uphill finish. They go over the Jouplan, which is probably one of the most difficult, like sneaky difficult stages of this entire tour. And then the descent off the backside is really quite technical and fast, and has been this exact finish has seen quite a few Tours de France kind of turned on their head, not least of which was 2006 with Floyd Landis. We could go all the way back to that extraterrestrial ride. Some other perhaps fueled performances. We had Marco Pantani take a victory on a very, well, almost identical finish back in 1997. This is like an icon. This particular sort of final 40K is very much an icon of the tour.
Richard Varenk also did some stuff there, I think. Got yellow jersey.
Yep.
Fueled by, you know.
Just fueled.
Yeah.
Yeah. Passion. Fueled by passion.
Fueled by passion.
Yep.
This stage is if I was one of the major GC candidates here, this stage is the trap stage for me. This is where everything can go wrong, because you've got five climbs, including three category ones, and then the Jouplan as an HC. You've got the descent into Morzine. Like, all of it just screams like the tension here would be just off the charts for these guys. So this is going to be an absolutely fascinating stage to watch. Whatever happens.
I kind of wish they'd stuck this one on Bastille Day, honestly. But yeah. I do think that the Grand Colombier stage, it will be a good Bastille Day stage. I think they're trying to turn the Grand Colombier into, you know, Alpe d'Huez of 20 years from now, like when they have used it a whole bunch, because they have used it a fair amount in the last decade. Anyway, that's a separate topic. If we get into stage 15, we are now deep in the Alps, and we will kind of stay there for a little bit. Leger to Saint-Gervais-Mont-Blanc. Now, I actually, as luck would have it, lived near here for 2 years and have ridden all these climbs many, many, many times. I'm intrigued to see how much they beat my Col de la Forclaz time and Col de Croix free time by on here. I think I've got some times on Strava there. My guess is by at least 50%. So I know this area really, really, really well, and I think that this stage is going to be incredibly, incredibly difficult. I highlighted this in the written route preview, but the Col de la Forclaz, which comes a fair ways from the finish line, it's at 82K in and 180-kilometer stage. I think that might, depending on how it's raced, that could potentially be a springboard for somebody who really needs to do something. And the reason I say that is, one, it's really steep. The top of the side that they're going up is double digits for the last few kilometers. And two, the backside is just this crazy twisty, like, one lane, incredibly narrow, incredibly difficult, incredibly fast. dissent. And so if somebody does want to, let's not call it pull a Landis, let's call it pull a Froome or something like that. This feels like a stage in which that is potentially possible, because it is so, the whole thing is kind of twisty and tight and up and down and up and down and up and down, to the point where having a big group is not going to be much help in the latter half of the stage.
I think one aspect of the route that really encourages that is that there is almost no time where you're going like down valley in one of those like longer flat sections. So if you are a solo escapee or in a small group, then you really are at an advantage, because there's not going to be those times where you're going to be fighting to just keep the gap from closing. You're always going up or downhill, and that absolutely privileges that breakaway.
Yeah. So I think, one, I think we're likely to see a breakaway on this stage of some sort. You know, this is the kind of day where if Wout van Aert is still in the race, if he hasn't left, you see Jumbo stick him in the breakaway, right? Because he could come back to Jonas Vingegaard, for example.
Will he, though? I don't know. He certainly seemed like a villain to me over the course of 7 episodes of a Netflix show I just watched.
But then they bring it around.
They bring it all back. 8.
They bring it all back. They bring it all back. If you haven't already, go catch our Unchained podcast. We got 8 episodes out. Unchained Binge podcast. Search for that wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll dig it out. Those were enjoyable to make. Anyway, I think that this is one of the hardest stages of the race. I actually marked down stage 17. We'll get to that in a second as the hardest stage in the race. But I go back and forth between that one and this one. It is. Like I said, having ridden all of these, not all at once, not in the same day, but having ridden every single one of the climbs on this stage multiple times, it's hard. It's just really, really hard.
Quick note about the finishing climb before we move on. If you look at the profile, you'll see it's a Cat 1 finish, 7K at 7.7%, which is pretty hard. But it sort of hides the fact that it's actually sort of a stair-step finale with a really, really, really steep lead-in to that. That's actually Cat 2. So the final, you know, half an hour will be really, really hard. It's not just the Cat 1 finish. It's really just, it's kind of two sections of really steep climbs separated by a really brief moment of respite.
Yeah, and again, I'll provide a little bit of on-the-ground insight here. The descent in between those two, like, I can't believe that they don't just consider it one climb, to be perfectly honest. The descent in between those two is literally, it's going to take them less than 2 minutes, right? Like, it is... It's narrow and steep and fast, but it's also like over before you even realize that you've started it. It's really, really short. And so effectively, this is one climb. And if you add those two together, it's really an HC. Like the finale of this is really an HC. And as you mentioned there, Dane, the beginning of it, the Côte d'Armoran is, I can't remember the exact gradient off the top of my head at the moment, but it's something like 14% for a kilometer or two. So basically, they're going to come down off the previous descent and come straight into the, it's like some of the steepest kilometers of the entire race. Basically, it's like here and the Puy de Dôme that are the sort of the nastiest bits, I think. So anyway, point being, hard stage, really hard stage, potential for lots of interesting stuff. Which brings us to the second rest day. July 17, we're into a rest day. We're going to get some, you know, do our laundry, hang out a little bit. We're up in the Alps still. And then we kick off the next day, stage 16, with the only time trial of the entire race. And to further annoy all of the time trialists in the bike race, it's got a big old climb in it. So even this one time trial, they couldn't give to anybody who weighs more than like 65 kilos.
Yeah, it's a climb that, I mean, it's only 2.5K, but 9.4 average percent. I'm kind of curious to see what, you know, the choices are made with the TT bikes and stuff. I mean, this is a steep, steep climb to do on a TT bike.
I've also ridden this climb, and I will say that it is not actually only 2.5K. It keeps climbing for another 3K after the top of that 2.5K, so I don't really know why they put the top of the climb there. It does level out quite a bit, so that first bit's 9.4%. I think it probably then sits at sort of like 4 to 6%. So, you know, big ring for these guys and TT bike and aero bars. My guess is that they run TT bikes throughout on this one. I don't think we're going to see bike changes, but it's a hard finish. It's not a climb to be scoffed at in the middle of a time trial.
Yeah, I was just going to mention the equipment changes aspect. I'm really curious to see what happens there. I agree. I think most riders are probably going to stick with their TT bikes just because the stage is pretty short at 22.4K. Doing a bike switch is progressively more of an issue there than it was certainly at something like the Giro with the Monte Lucari climb or that kind of thing. But I think equipment choices are going to matter a lot, and as is pacing, because as you mentioned, Kaylee, even at the top of that climb, it's not over. There's this like sort of gentle climbing to the finish, and anybody who goes too hard on that climb is going to find themselves in a world of hurt for the last 3K.
Indeed. You know, as time trials go, I like this one. I think, you know, we've had our fair share of debates over time trials there, Dane. And I like this one. I think it the jeopardy is high, and so therefore I think it works.
I'm on Team Kaylee here. I find time trial results interesting, but not often time trials themselves, and I think this could be an exception.
I think it could be good.
Kaylee, you have a friend in this very apartment. We were watching Tour de France Unchained recently, and my fiance turned to me and said, why do they do time trials? It just seems like they're throwing this random thing into the race that just for the 1 or 2 days, and then they go back to doing everything else. Why do they even do them? And I had to defend time trials good to question. Her as well.
What did you say, Dane? What did you
say?
Without
time trials, then the race would just be for the tiny climber dudes, and you need to balance it out so there's multiple skill sets being rewarded.
Unless the time trial is like this.
Unless the time trial has a 9% climb.
I mean, the reality is it's still going to be... This is one of those TTs where whoever wins the Tour de France probably wins this time trial, right? Because it's going to be this, like, it's the straight up strongest rider that's going to win this time trial. That's the way that it's designed. And, you know, dead flat time trial, maybe Stefan Kuhn wins or something like that. This is going to be like Pogacar or Vingegaard is going to win this time trial. Like, I would put lots of money on that, on one of those two things happening, which is, you know, it's kind of fun. Like I would, if they're both still close and they're both still duking it out, they will very much use this as an opportunity to like, well, you get pretty much guaranteed time gain or time loss in a time trial, right? Because you can't see where the other guy is. So yeah, it'll be good. It'll be a really good stage. Let's keep moving. Stage 17, we are still in the Alps. We're in the sense of Saint-Gervais-Mont-Blanc to Courchevel. Courchevel, another sort of classic day in the Alps. Who wants to run me through it?
I'll take us through it. You got two early Cat 1s, which will, you know, cause some fatigue and almost certainly see a breakaway, get some time, I think. There's the Côte de Longuefoy. Sorry to the French. Spanish is really more my thing, which is Cat 2, sort of appetizer for the famous Col de la Luz, which is the highest point of this year's race, the Souvenir Henri de Grange, 2,300 meters. And it sort of answers the question of, you know, why don't you just combine two climbs into one? Because there is a brief section where they go downhill and then they go back uphill again. So over the course of the whole Or category climb, it's 28.1K mostly of climbing. It's not that steep, but it's pretty hard. You would think there's going to be some serious losses for anyone who's not feeling good this day.
Well, and the Col de la Luz itself is really steep. So, yeah, like the sort of the average there is somewhat, somewhat disingenuous.
Yeah, with the in-between section kind of brings the average down. Yeah,
exactly. But the last couple kilometers of the Col de la Luz, which they go on literally a bike path, it sits at, I'm looking at the profile right now, 9.1, 10.9, 10.99, 9.7% for those last kilometers. And that is a serious, serious climb. And then it all is also worth noting. So they drop down into Courchevel, the Altaport in Courchevel, and then it actually kicks up to the finish. So yes, it's a descent into the finish, sort of. But the very final, like 800 meters or so, is 18%. Up to the Altaport in Courchevel. So just because you have made it over the Col de la Luz does not mean that someone's not going to, you know, give it a good kick and take a couple seconds out of you on that little finale.
I think this stage is the kind of thing where anybody who's showing a little bit of fatigue, or even, and I mean mental fatigue, is in potential trouble here, because the finish is really tricky. You've got the Lowe's has a high altitude summit. It's 2,300 meters. And then you've got, like you said, Kaylee, you've got this descent to the final kick up at the Altaport. But I was looking at the finish profile, and the way that they get onto the Altaport itself is a little strange. The road actually goes underneath the bottom of the runway, and they're actually going to build. So they go through this really short tunnel, and then they're going to build a ramp, basically, that gets them onto the runway. And that ramp is literally like a super tight 180 turn. So it's almost like positioning is going to be an issue. But like, if you're the least bit asleep at the switch, then you're probably going to get gapped off.
Yep. Yep. It's going to be a wild finish. And like I said, I kind of marked this off as potentially sort of on paper the hardest stage of the race, because we've got two Cat 1s, a Cat 2, and an Or category, 165K. Part of the reason I did that, and again, I'm kind of torn between this stage 15 and 13. Part of the reason I did that is the high altitude sort of summit at Col de la Lowe's. And Lowe's, I think, is maybe the strong or the hardest climb in the entire race. Add that to the fact that we're pretty deep into the tour at this point, and fatigue is definitely setting in. It's been, you know, you just had a pretty solid effort and a time trial the day before. I think this is potentially the hardest day on paper. Which gets us into leaving the Alps. Stage 18, Moutier to Bourg-en-Bresse. It's a flat stage. It's going to be there's two more opportunities for Mark Cavendish. Three more opportunities for Mark Cavendish. This is one of them. We're going to keep it after that. Sprint stages, not a whole lot to talk about. Stage 19, finish in Poligny, 173K. Another stage that I would imagine we see a breakaway go away, and very much determined by whether the sprinters want it enough, whether they want to bring it back or not. We've got a Cat 4 early. We got a Cat 3 kind of 20-something K from the finish. Neither of which are too scary, although, you know, for a pure sprinter, that Cat 3 at the end could potentially do some damage. And then we get to this stage that I'm quite excited about. Now, I'm only excited about this if the race is still tight. Stage 20, Belfort to Le Marcstein. This is up in the Vosges, and it's a really hard stage. Cat 2, Cat 2, Cat 2, Cat 3, Cat 1, Cat 1, finish. And part of the reason why I have this one marked off as another potential trap, much like we mentioned earlier, is there's very little valley riding, much like we were talking about on the previous one. And that makes it really good for some kind of long-distance raid or something like that. And I think that, if we see a Pogacar off the back of the yellow jersey, I feel like he would be the more likely of the two to just go ham on this particular stage, and it could be really interesting.
Yeah, I think, as you mentioned, Kaylee, the lack of valley riding is an issue. It's also a short stage. It's only 133.5 kilometers, so obviously that makes it more, you know, more likely that somebody will gamble and be aggressive. I think the finish is interesting. That the fact that it is not a summit finish also potentially sort of tips it to me to be a possible spot for a long distance raid, because I don't think it's the kind of thing where a guy can just attack on that final climb, the Col de Platz or Wassel, get a gap and then hold that to the finish. I think it's the kind of thing where he's, you know, you'll want to have the gap going into all of that and basically feel like you've got a chance to be able to hold that over the climb, and that the pack will eventually just sort of give up and say, oh, the hell with it.
Yeah, I think the stage goes one of two directions. It's either going to be chaos and we're going to get some long distance attacks and things like that, or it's going to be a real dud because of that finish, because of that long, flat, like, you know, decent amount of distance from the top of Platzerwassel, I think. I'm not really familiar with that particular climb. They're up near the German border there. Between the top of that and Le Marcstein. It is also worth noting that this is a similar stage to the one where Annemiek van Vleuten basically won the Tour de France Femme last year. Slightly different in that they went over this set of climbs a bit earlier, but it did feature in that stage where she ended up taking, 3.5 minutes or something like that on Demi Vollering. So we've seen that exact sort of long distance raid happen in the last year on a very similar route up in that region. So there we go. That's the final mountain stage, final real stage of the Tour de France. And from there, we just head to Paris. Starts outside Paris, as always, finishes on the Champs-Élysées. And the bike race is over. Of course, the other thing that's happening on that particular Sunday is the Tour de France Femme is beginning down in Clermont-Ferrand. How much money did Clermont-Ferrand give to ASO to get it? Like, we spend 5 days there in the men's race, and then it's the start of the women's race as well. And I can't say I'm that excited about Clermont. Clermont-Ferrand is like, it's where Michelin is headquartered. It's where it was founded, tire manufacturer. It has a large soot-blackened cathedral. Otherwise, it is not a particularly interesting place to be in general, sort of by French standards, where there's lots of interesting places. So I don't really get this one. Anyway, that was a bit of a tangent. My point being, we will have a big preview of Tour de France Femme as we get a bit closer to that. We will also have a number of reporters on the ground at Tour de France Femme. So if you are hoping for that material, that is coming, but that race is, well, it's still a month away as opposed to the men's race, which starts a bit over a week. Dane, Joe, anything else to add about this this year's tour?
I mean, I'm always really looking forward to the tour, but I do love this route. I think it should be a pretty interesting race. I tend to like more time trial-y routes, but I think this one, as climbers' races go, because it's so, yeah, Joe, you said distributed. It's very well distributed. I like that adjective for it, and I think it's going to lead to some really good racing.
Yeah, I would say that I'm really pleased to see the tour organization take some risks with this route because it is such a kind of a non-traditional route. I'm sure that there will be some grumbling about that, but I think the selection that they picked out is hopefully going to make for a really exciting race and a race that stays suspenseful late in the race, so that like that the Mark Steyn climb, that stage is not a dud where it's just a breakaway thing, because hopefully the GC is still up for grabs.
Agreed. I think it's going to be a good tour. You know, we had one of the best tours in recent memory last year, and the two riders that made it so are back, and I'm very excited about that. We are going to be doing a big contenders preview this weekend on the Pretty Serious Bike Racing podcast. If you listen to us on our sort of main escape channel, you will obviously get that. If you don't, if you just listen to us on the Placeholders channel, you'll need to head over and dig that one out. That's coming, what, Monday, right, Dane?
Yeah, yep.
Next Monday. And that'll go deep, 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 deep on all the contenders, and both the yellow jersey and the green jersey and the polka dots and all the rest. We are headed to France pretty soon here. We're going to have a large team on the ground, and we will be running daily podcasts from the Tour de France. Now, if you are already subscribed to this channel, you don't have to do anything. You just have to keep listening. They're just going to start showing up. We're going to call them the Tour Dailies, so you'll see that in the title. But yeah, they're going to start off end of next week once we hit the ground in Bilbao. Before we sign off for the day, I have one request. The Tour de France is a big deal for us in bike media. It's a big deal for everybody who loves cycling. And as you all know, we are a pretty new media company. Like, we're fresh-faced, baby-faced over here. We are, what, 3 months old, 4 months old, something like that? Very much in a growth phase, I would say. And what would really help us out, because I know that all of you love what we do, is if you share what we do. Tell your friends who are into the tour about Escape Collective. Send them to the website. Send them to the podcast. Tell them about the Tour Dailies. Tell them about the Unchained Binge podcast. Word of mouth is our best marketing at this point. And every single person that you share this with is, you know, potentially another whole web of listeners and readers and all the rest. And as you know, we are entirely reliant on those listeners and readers for our continued existence. So share us, please. Leave a review in iTunes or wherever else you listen to your podcast. Leave us a rating and sign up. Head over to escapecollective.com/join and make sure that you are fully signed up and ready to go before the Tour de France begins. I guarantee you that paywall is going to be a bit frustrating if you hit it in the first week of the tour. So let's get rid of it. Head over to escapecollective.com/join. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week from France with, well, it'll be me and Johnny and... not quite Ian yet, and Ronan in the first week. And then a whole other collection of Escape Collective crew popping in and out throughout the race. So thanks for joining us, and we'll chat next week. Bye-bye.
See you.